14, we took a little trip along with Colonel Jackson down the mighty Mississippi. We took a little bacon and we took a little beans, and we caught the bloody British in a town in New Orleans.
We fired our guns and the British men were coming. There wasn't as many as there was a while ago. We fired once more and they began to run down the Mississippi to the Gulf of Mexico.
And we see the British come, and they must have been 100 of them beating all the drum. The steps so high, and they made the bugle swing. We stood beside our cotton bales, didn't say a thing.
Really old song by Johnny Horton, The Battle of New Orleans, and that song is about our freedom. And we're going to talk about our freedom tonight. This is BBS Radio. The show is Sound Health, and I'm your host, Sherry Edwards. On this show, we attempt to bring you ideas and information to try to make your life a little easier, a lot freer, and to help you move toward self-responsibility. As many of you know, I run a research institute in southeastern Ohio called the Institute of Bioacoustic Biology. And we've got a special project going that I'd like to share with you, and then we'll have our guest come on. It's Eli Mellor. He's been with us previously. We had a great response to his show, and he's agreed to come back and talk to us about something that we're all concerned about today, the elections and the economy. So the project that we are doing is for the Army, and it's about helping the guys, the soldiers that are coming back that have traumatic brain injury. And there's really no way to measure that injury on the battlefield. And so the Army asked us to see if we could come up with a way using what we do, vocal analysis, to see if we could determine if somebody was fit for battle. So we found a protein in the brain that we can measure through the voice, and we can measure that to the degree that it will tell the medical people whether or not that soldier can go back into the field, because that's one of the problems. There are these close proximity blasts, and the guys are damaged, and they say, well, no, I'm fine, I'm okay, out of loyalty to their buddies, and really because they think they're okay. And then that second blast really does them in, and we end up with people who are very damaged mentally. So we not only did we do something with traumatic brain injury, but we came in and we're starting to look at neurotransmitters. And we've been able to help other people here at the Institute who had similar kinds of things from civilian life. So we think we can help the soldiers too. So we've created the computer programs. We've created the classes to help people learn to use these programs. It'll be a two-day class to teach you to take it to your community. And then also be dealing with referrals for people that call here and want the service. So please get in touch with us. I think it's a point of a national honor that we help these guys, although there's not a lot of national honor left, and that's why we ask Eli to come on the show with us. Eli Mellor, thank you for coming on the show and taking time out of your busy day.
Well, it's my pleasure.
I feel like with the elections that's going on, the economy that's happening, I don't want to say the downfall of Ron Paul. I just think he was deliberately squashed, and I know you're a supporter. But what happened to the dream of the American public? Where's it going?
Well, it's been in jeopardy for a number of years because primarily it's been abused and taken for granted. It hasn't by the succeeding generations that inherited the dream, that were the benefactors of the dream, have not, shall we say, really appreciated the roots. By roots, I mean the principles, the underlying ethics, the ideologies that were, shall we say, the roots of the dream. They were the benefactors, and at least the last two or three generations, each subsequent generation, has taken it for granted, I think, and it, certainly in part, and not understood how the dream needs to be continued to be nurtured in order for it to have, shall we say, a real prospect of being materialized. Our society has developed as a consequence of the perceptions of the pursuit of these dreams, of these expectations, and has metamorphized into something that is unrealistic to sustain any further, not practical, not beneficial, not realistic. And so we're witnessing the not only the fracturing of the dream, but the disintegration of it, the literal disintegration of it, and the very fast and speedy disintegration of it. many of us are beginning to experience a new type of fear that hasn't beset our society for a long time. It could be argued 1929. It could be argued, when the North and the South decided to war against each other in the 19th century. There are many pinnacles, if you will, in which there are adjustments made in which people are, shall we say, forced to deal with certain realities, certain principles, certain ideologies that they've forgotten, that they've taken for granted. We see that certainly in 1929, after the Roaring Twenties, in which was a prosperous time, and then all of a sudden, kaboom. We've experienced it in lesser forms with various recessions of less nature since 1929 in this country. But the exploitation of these principles, of these roots of these of this dream, of the American dream, have been so profound over the last decade, particularly the last decade, that they're no longer practical. They're no longer rooted in common sense, if you will, but hinged upon a world of superfluous fiction, benefits and privileges, expectations, deserves, rights, indignation on the part of groups, intolerance on the part of groups, groups gathering together to identify their egos and not expand on the capacity of their hearts to care about their fellow man. So, in other words, the fruit is spoiling before it drops from the tree, and that which does is picked, that is good, is less and less. That which is ruinous, spoiled, unedible, unusable, is beginning to increase. And we see this throughout our society now. Institutions that had been originally created behind some very genuine and fundamental important principles are no longer relevant today. They're masquerading around. They're really dead dinosaurs, if you will, as I wrote a number of years ago. We begin to see this unfold all over the place. The institutions that we thought were there to protect us, to give us stability, turn out to be hollow, turn out to be arenas where enormous abuses and leverage and homes for greed and self-promotion, to the point that they've reached the pinnacle, the end of the road, if you will. There has to be a comeuppance, if you will, not from the standpoint of punishment, but from the standpoint of hopefully learning to our society, to our citizens. but that's also in jeopardy, because we've traded our capacity to learn for benefits and privileges as well, and many of us don't know where to go to get the truth any longer. We can't find it. We lift up this, we read that, we go on the internet searching ambitiously for it, and we walk away with less than what we expected.
Eli, so this loss of hope that you're talking about, do you think that's from internal perspective of people who have lost their honor and their pride? Or what you're saying is that our government and big business and other things have eroded it and we've allowed it to happen because we're complacent?
Well, we've certainly allowed it to happen. We've been a part of it. This isn't that there's an alien race that is, you know, putting this upon us against our will. We've created these institutions. We support these corporations. We support the benefits and privileges that our generation or the current generations truly expect from Social Security to Medicare to health coverage to 401ks, benefits, privileges. We have very quickly in the life of man, I mean, when we consider, for example, and this is something I oftentimes refer to because it's such a cornerstone of the fraud that's been perpetrated on our society since the end of the Second World War, we forget the basic meanings of terms and of words, their roots, their original meanings. We don't care. We attach the meanings that seem to be politically correct or apropos for our age, for our generation, and we move forward. And one of those huge, huge areas, one of those cornerstones that hopefully in that which we're faced to deal with in the coming months and years in our society will reveal, so that we can get down to common denominators and find a bottom, find a foundation that we can build upon and let all of this goofy stuff go, is, and this is just one of many we can touch upon here if you'd like, and that's marriage, the marriage license. The term marriage license is something that is taken universally, accepted universally. We see people arguing and fighting about what marriage rights are. Marriage, some argue, it should be left with reserved for only a man and a woman. Others argue, oh no, shouldn't have anything to do with that. It is really, if two people love each other, regardless of their sex or their race, they should be entitled to be married. And yet we see routinely that those states that are forced to deal with this issue always, without exception, Supreme Courts, from Massachusetts to California and otherwise, eventually rule that, yes, a marriage license can entitles you to marry somebody of the same sex. As a matter of fact, and of course the courts haven't ruled on this, but a marriage license also entitles you to marry your dog, if you'd like. We forget that at the end of the Second World War, I believe there were, I stand to be corrected on this, but I believe there were only four or five states in our Union at the end of the First World War that permitted marriage licenses. And by the end of the Second World War, there were less than 14, I think there were 11 states, that permitted marriage licenses. Now, 50 years later or so, there isn't a state in the land that not only permits them, but mandates them. Marriage licenses. Well, how long have marriage licenses been around? Well, if we ask that question or bold enough for the answer, we learn that the first marriage license was constructed and initiated before the Civil War. I believe it was in the 1840s in, I believe, Knoxville, Tennessee. a rich plantation owner wanted to marry his mulatto slave, he wanted to take her to church, and he wanted to have an open relationship, one he didn't have to hide, have her in her home and have children and such. And he went to the city and he said, you know, that library that you want, I can make that happen if you give me and permit me to have this relationship. Well, prior to the Civil War, it was almost unheard of for a white person and a black person to have to be wedded, to be married. And so the city of Knoxville, I believe, issued the first marriage licenses and defined it in law. And it's been squeaking through our society up until the end of the Second World War, where it took off slowly but surely, and eventually all states in the Union adopted it. We go to Black's Law Dictionary, and we learn, for example, that a marriage license is permission granted by public authority to persons who wish to intermarry. And the root definition of that term hasn't changed since its creation in the 19th century. We forget why the word marriage is prohibited from being used in the ceremony. It doesn't, that ceremony doesn't go, do you take this man to be your legally married husband? Those are not the words that are used. The words that are used are carried over from early English law, which state, do you take this man to be your lawful wedded husband? The words lawful and wedded means something a little bit different than legally married. But our current generation doesn't understand that. They don't see that. And so they end up buying into a different notion. And so it changes the dream. The dream, when we were talking a moment ago about the roots, the things that nourish the dream, they get contaminated. And they get contaminated with the false messenger, a false message, a variation of the truth, and subsequent generations think they're so certain about something that they're willing to demonstrate, they're willing to fight. My goodness, they feel insulted they feel hurt. They think somehow, some way, marriage should be strictly restricted to a man and a woman. Well, but a marriage license is a license of privilege. It is a cornerstone, it turns out, to the fraud, the virtual fraud that's been perpetrated generation after generation in our country upon people, that believing that they need a license before they can be legally married, not understanding the difference between the word legal and lawful. And without question, young people adopt that along with their parishioners. I can remember 30 years ago, there was, four, and in some jurisdictions, five or six churches that would wed you without a license. Today, you can't find one out of ten that will, because the churches themselves have become 501c3s and are part of the government, if you will, part of the tax and revenue scheme of things. And just to bring this current as to why this is relevant, why this is important to talk about on your radio show, to peel back this veneer and get down to the basics so that we can find solutions to correct our dilemmas, so we can address our fears with the truth instead of, constantly looking around for benefits and privileges, which will only result in us falling deeper into the mire, is a revelation that the Treasury Department made in approximately, I believe it was August, September of 2004, before the just a couple of months before the last national election. And they revealed that as of December 2003, that the Treasury Department had collected some nearly $90 billion of revenue from the marriage penalty tax. And people today... when they hear those words, they go, $90 billion from the marriage penalty tax? You mean that fee that you pay to get a marriage license? No. You see, since a marriage license is a license of privilege. It is giving one permission to do an unlawful act. And what is the unlawful act? We look in the dictionary. Permission granted by public authority to persons who wish to intermarry. And if we were to ask people in your listening audience, what does the word intermarry mean? There are some dictionaries that have dropped the word completely out of their pages because along with a number of other words that those in power, those who want to keep the tax revenue base as it is, don't want people to know. But if you ask people, well, does the word intermarry sound, does it sound good? Does it sound like if I said your parents, for example, intermarried, would I be giving them a compliment or a slur? And most people would say, I think a slur. But then you'd ask them, why do you think it's a slur? And they'd have trouble in realizing or putting their arms around why it's a slur. Well, this is an example of what our genetic memory. Internally, we know something's wrong with the word, but we really don't know what it is. So if we go back to a genuine dictionary of a few decades ago and look up the word intermarry, we learn that intermarry is with, the first definition of intermarry is within your own family, fourth cousin forward, and the second definition is of a person of another race. And this definition comes is inherited from Deuteronomy in the Bible. The license gives us permission to do something other than to wed. And so when we then come back to the government and we identify ourselves as husband and wife on a 1040, we're letting the government in law actually know, let them know that we are engaged in unlawful behavior. And so they turn around and they punish us with a marriage penalty tax, which comes out to be roughly around $1,600 for filing jointly. Very few accountants, for example, will admit that and tell you, but it's true. Eventually, some people realize that it's better by filing separately and by keeping their birth names, even though they, quote-unquote, are married. Don't understand why, but at least from an income tax standpoint, they're saving $1,600. And then on top of that, that 1040 scheme says, but don't worry, Mr. and Mrs. Jones, or Mr. and Mrs. Newlywedded, newly married couple. If you have a child, well, you can break even because we'll give you a deduction on that child. And all further children that become dependents, well, those are other deductions. And so our society has fallen into this economic scheme that is based upon falsehoods, that are based upon misinformation to such an extent that not only do they believe it, but they will go to war to protect it. We want our Social Security. We deserve our Social. Don't reduce our benefits. Don't take away our Social Security. And yet the whole system is based upon a fraud. And now we see decades later, after it was created, that there's no way that it can continue to perpetuate, that it has a point in time and space of collapse. And are we people enough, are we self-honest enough to recognize the causes of the disease within the dreams that we have inherited? For example, our grandparents, some of us grandparents, back in the 1930s, when they came out with the Social Security Act of they were quite reluctant in passing it, and they were suspicious. They felt that there was something wrong about this. However, push came to shove, and push came to shove in reverse, and the people of this country said, okay, we'll go along with this, we'll go ahead and approve this on one condition, and that is that our children and our grandchildren and our great-great-grandchildren will always know that the system is voluntary. And so the government said, okay, we'll make this as part of primary law. And indeed, if you check with Social Security and check with the law, you'll learn very quickly that Social Security is strictly voluntary. But try to tell that to people who are living today. it's very difficult to find one in 100,000 people who not only don't have a Social Security number, but they can live without one because everything is connected to the fiction, to the benefits and privileges there too. And so what we see, I believe, unraveling before our eyes as we look at our television screens and go, oh my goodness, the market dropped 400 points today. Oh my goodness, it dropped 500 points yesterday. When is it going to stop? What does this all mean? Major institutions are collapsing. They're falling apart. They're being bigger fish are eating the big fish, and where is this all going to end? How is this going to play out on the America? Oh, they just guaranteed $85 billion here, another $100 billion there. What does this all mean? It means that the dream of, for example, attached to the dollar, which has a dream that has perpetuated itself throughout the world as a major currency, is beginning to fall apart and fall apart at the seams. And, there was a time in the early 30s that Germany was a very prosperous nation, late 20s, early 30s. However, it came to pass that before the Second World War, it cost 1 million German marks to buy a loaf of bread. And the reason it did is because the people of that society overextended themselves. Okay, they lost touch with their dreams. And the reflection of their dreams, the denominator for their work and for their sweat and for their hopes and their prayers, their currency, begin to erode. And that's what we're seeing here today. That's what we're seeing. We're looking around for leadership. We lift up this rock. We lift up this page. We open this book. We turn on this television station. And nowhere can we find leadership. Who's going to lead us out of this mire?
Eli, we should let people know that you're a constitutionalist. And could you explain a little bit of that? And then I want to go back and talk a lot more about the economy and the elections and what's going on there.
Well, I'm not sure if the word constitutionist best describes me, but the Constitution was put together by men who feared the power of the world of privilege. And they understood that they were creating fundamental departments of government and the three branches, but they wanted to limit those powers and create a mechanism or a formula to sustain beyond their years. And so the Constitution, more so than anything else, it talks about limitations on the abuses of those powers, if you will, because unless those powers are restrained, the whole thing can collapse, and they'll be back where they started from, which is where they ran from when they came to this country to seek something different than what they had were encountering in the privileged classes of England and France and Europe. we have long ago, parted company with the Constitution in this country. Few people, virtually every court that you walk into today, if you started to argue constitutional things, the judge would look at you and say, don't bring that constitutional stuff in this court. And people go, well, why not? I thought the Constitution, because you're in the wrong court. You're in the wrong jurisdiction. You must understand where you must enter these arguments, and this court doesn't happen to be one of them. And so, we forget about the amendments and the effects that the amendments has had to that Constitution, most particularly the 16th and the 14th Amendment. And the 14th Amendment opened the door to repay Russia back for the money they loaned the North to win the war. And forget where the word Social Security actually originated from, the concept behind it, which also happened to come from Russia. Nevertheless, it began to set in motion a privileged class that now dominates the scene. So instead of people cherishing words like work and matrimony, they're told, well, unless you get a marriage license, you can, and that husband of yours does something, why, you don't have a foot to stand on. You don't want one of those common law marriages. You've got to be legally married if you're going to defend yourself. You need Social Security. You need benefits and privileges. And now we hear, as a cornerstone of at least one party in particular now, what we need in this country is universal health care. That's what's important. Why? Why do we need universal health care? Is the question I'm bold enough to ask. Why aren't we bold enough to say we shouldn't have any health care? That's a benefit and privilege. If we had no health care, guess what doctors would do? They'd be a whole lot more accountable, okay, their fees, and rather than running you off for this test and that test, they would revert back to genuine diagnosis, genuine caring, genuine responsibility and accountability, and that would interpret that the cost of rendering caring to the ill and misfortune would plummet from the levels that it's currently at, which are supported by insurance companies. And so we could talk about a number of examples in our society where things have evolved, as I was pointing out earlier, from the essence of how they were created in the first place. They've changed, they've metamorphized into something considerably different. And I don't believe that there are any, most of them, many of them, are any longer relevant, useful, productive for us to continue to entertain. And so we're seeing a real big change unfold before us with the events that are going on around us today.
Didn't you run for vice president, Eli?
No.
Oh, I've gotten you mixed up with somebody. I thought you were involved high up in politics. Tell me what's going on with the elections today.
I beg your pardon?
Tell me what you think is going on with elections today.
Well, free discourse is enormously discouraged. I mean, Ron Paul is a perfect example of this. Had Ron Paul run for office 50 years ago, he would have been unanimously elected as president in a New York minute. But not today, because our society is dominated by the corporate scene, and he threatens that establishment. He's talking about fundamentals, that he's talking about the very things I'm referring to him a little bit differently and less articulately than Mr. Paul would. But nevertheless, I believe that he and I are on generally the same page in that regard. I have a great deal of respect for him. And his courage and his focus on understanding how do we get back to what's important, to what's at essence, so that we can dispense with this superfluous world of benefits and privileges and get back to basics, get back to lawful currency, get back to which is the gold standard, do away with the Federal Reserve, and so many of these departments in government that are serving no useful purpose other than deteriorating human capital, starting with our children.
We did a vocal print on Ron Paul and did a comparison with other presidents, and his voice is almost identical to John F. Kennedy.
Oh, is it?
I found that wonderful. Mm. Why do you think... Oh, I'm going to back up here a minute. Some of the things that Ron Paul stands for, integrity, truth, government without interference, freedom, stand behind what you say. How much of his influence do you see in the elections, the president and vice president that's going on right now?
Unfortunately, very little. Unfortunately, very little. I there may be a few threads here and there, but they've been so successful, the two parties have been so successful in ignoring any splinter candidate or group, and essentially consequently suffocated their message away from that which those arguments that dominate the public scene at this juncture. which are basically talking about personalities, talking about egos, talking about the most superfluous, ridiculous kinds of things, rather than proving up their ability to deal with and bring to the table solutions to the problems that not only do we face at this moment, that unless we deal with them now, we're going to pay even further consequences for them in the future, because we're not being self-honest with ourselves as a society. Mr. Paul understands this, I'm sure. I know he does. And within that understanding is a great deal of uncertainty and hurt and caring and suffering, those of us that do, for our fellow man, because we see what lies ahead and not too far in the future now, we're essentially, as a society, seeing ourselves implode upon each other.
Well, one of the things I see with Ron Paul is that people come first and freedom comes first, but it comes at a price that the people need to be willing to pay. I need to say that you're listening to BBS Radio, and with these folks that run this station, people come first. And what's your opinion about the issues about Pale Sarah, because that sort of blindsided people? Nobody knew where that was coming from. Why was she chosen? Why did they wait when they announced they chose her in March, but they waited until after Obama chose Biden? What's really going on there?
Well, I did a press release in February predicting that Mr. McCain would become our next president. I did not see Sarah Palin then, but it is quite convenient. She is a convenient answer to the conservative corporate culture in which she is a woman. She brings forth and resembles and reflects issues that have been suffocated by women in the past, and so it was clear when Hillary was not going to get the nomination, when she threw in the towel, that segment of our population was suffering. They did not have a voice that resonated their concerns or their wishes or their hopes or their aspirations. And so it was a void in which Sarah Palin very easily is filling, and we're seeing the enthusiasm, the rave, the almost fanaticism, if you will, that has come forth since she was revealed, falls right in line with plans I believe our corporate structure has for the future, unfortunately, other than, you know, for her ability to, or for their ability to, rattle the cages and reorganize the farm in Washington to be more transparent, to be get some of the greed and stuff out, I wish them well. That's an admirable objective. It's one that certainly Mr. Paul endorses on its face. How they do and what they do with it, and whether or not they'll be able to stay unscathed, untouched, uncontaminated from the effects of billions and billions of dollars of bribe and of influence remains to be seen. It is serving them well, because inherently the people know that they're on the right page, that there's something wrong in Denmark, if you will. Otherwise, these institutions that they relied upon wouldn't be failing.
We did Sarah Palin's vocal print, and she is very truthful. She's very stable. Are you saying that... Well, I don't know what question I'm asking. Of all the vocal prints that we did, at this point, she is the most able to run a presidency. I can't vote for her because I can't vote for Mick Bush, you know? I can't tolerate the idea of four more years of what's going on now. I feel totally unfree in my own country. Forced vaccinations, the stock market going crazy, demands from HMOs about what kind of health care I should have. First, what's your prediction now about the election?
Well, I haven't changed since my prediction in February.
So still McClain for you.
Please don't misunderstand me. By prediction doesn't mean that that's what I hope will occur, okay, or wish to occur. That's just a prediction, and I think it's a fair prediction under the circumstances, and I think that the stats and the developments of the last few weeks move toward the fulfillment of that prediction. Ideally, I wish that Ron Paul could be in the limelight and have won his party's nomination, if we're talking about wishes. No, that was just a prediction. Unfortunately, not only Mr. McCain, but certainly Ms. Palin, are easily attached, influenced by the Bush machine, the Bush establishment, the military complex. So they pose no threat to that establishment, if you will. May indeed provide some interim support for hope of our citizens for a two, maybe 2.5 years once he's elected, and things seem to be corrected and the people seem to be more at ease as they were with Ronald Reagan, their confidence in their government partially restored. But once Mr. McCain passes, I'm afraid that we'll find ourselves back in the same kind of predicament. That's just my person.
We predicted he was also in frail health. His immune system, from his vocal print, shows extreme stress.
You mean Mr. McCain?
Yes.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Who do you think's really in charge? Does it matter who's president? Who's in charge here?
What does the Bible say? The person who has the goal makes the rules. when it gets down to it, we cannot underestimate the influence of the military complex. The military complex has been created to sustain and to secure the promotion of capitalism and of the corporate structure, as opposed to communism, for example. That's its whole purpose. It's still dedicated to that purpose. It's still committed to that purpose, regardless of the fact that the reasons for its purpose are beginning to fall apart. And if we look a little closer, we see that the military is fractured here and there and almost everywhere itself. But from a financial standpoint, from a technology standpoint, there's still a great deal of power and influence the Pentagon has. Neither McCain or Palin pose a threat to that, if you will. They're friendly to that, and the arguments that support that. Indeed, Palin is a fresh face on the scene, and the opposition side are beginning to experience a loss of credibility, a loss of aspiration, a loss of belief and hope.
What do you think is going to happen if the Obama-Biden ticket gets in? Are you speechless? I've never heard you speechless.
Well, I was taking an opportunity to measure my words. We're on public air here. If you asked Wall Street that, Wall Street would be further bearish with that administration, recognizing that the solutions that they have, that they hold out, are typically a typical Democrat, and they're talking about funding to the extent of a half to three quarters of $1 trillion programs that they believe, once funded, would create less suffering and more equity and equality amongst the people of the land. Our country, unfortunately, should not, cannot afford to be burdened with any more expenses. It is up to its eyeballs in debt, and everywhere we've borrowed from countries all over the world. We're a consuming nation. We have to get back to understanding what unique advantage, what unique assets we have that the rest of the world want, besides the marketing of fancy-dancy corporations with their ads and such. But behind the scenes, they're importing labor, and they have no obligation, no commitment, no mandate to protect the citizens of any land that they use. And so when they've used up the most of human capital in the United States, for example, we see them moving abroad and doing the same kind of thing that they did here. They're almost a scourge on the land. I am a supporter of a substantially different kind of concept in which we, as users of Social Security, take back some of our constitutional rights, if you will, and since the system is voluntary, we have the ability, the option, without guns, without blood loss or suffering, to merely inform the corporations on December 31st that they're no longer entitled to use our Social Security number. And that would have a profound effect across the land.
You think people should collectively do that?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
Is there
absolutely.
Any kind?
Absolutely. I think it's a brilliant idea. It's one I've had for well more than a decade. It's one that is before its time, if you will.
Are you organizing that?
I'm involved in other things, but the time isn't now, using a quotation from myself, people don't see the value in that. The first thing that they see is, we wouldn't have a job. Well, they don't understand their ability, their ease, and power to take back the power that they've given up by handing that out.
Why aren't the unions involved?
And what would that mean if they sent a letter to their employer saying that they no longer have their permission to use their Social Security number starting January 1st?
Why aren't the unions involved in this?
Well, because the unions are as dependent upon the Social Security number as anyone else.
Well, it looks like they have the power to pull the people together and say, you know, we're a union here and we're not letting you use our Social Security number anymore.
Well, union is a privilege itself, okay? It is an organization that takes a certain amount of rights from its members and pools those rights to represent them in a manner that they themselves cannot represent themselves and try to cut a better deal with the corporations that they work for. It's insane. What it does, it creates a word and supports a word, embellishes a word that is otherwise called jobs. People think that the most important thing is jobs, and that's not correct. The most important thing is work, because from work we can restore what pride in workmanship, what pride in apprenticeship is, what pride in passing knowledge on and mentoring our know-how and our knowledge.
That's a lot to ask, Eli, that somebody go to their company and say, you cannot use my Social Security. The first thing they're going to do is say, you're fired. You've written
then,
a
if
lot.
If everybody did that, the corporations would collapse, wouldn't they?
They wouldn't.
Their assets would then fall in the hands of the citizens of this country, wouldn't it?
You've written a lot of articles about this. How can people get in touch with you?
Well, they can visit my website, thetimeisnow.us, and it is an old website. It is currently being substantially remodeled, but my gift, if you will, 30 years in the making. I've written three manuscripts, published all three of them. One in starting in December of 1979, the second one in late 1990, and the third one in December of 2001, just a few weeks after 9/11. And with that, and on the website, are 12 good reasons why the time is now. In there and in my writings are the answers to their questions. I believe, in part, solutions to our future. Yes, I mean, you can look at my suggestion from two different ways. You can look at it from the standpoint of, oh, my goodness, that would mean that everybody would lose their jobs. It would also mean that corporations would collapse in a New York minute because they wouldn't have any slaves. They wouldn't have any worker. They wouldn't have any people that were, you know, pleading with them for benefit and privileges called a job. Okay, it would transform society. Along with that, one of the other components of that process is a complete revamp of our tax structure. You see, taxes, for example, have not changed in essence since Babylon, where they were developed, where our tax structure is evolved. And virtually all societies have similar, if not exact, tax structures. Nothing has been done. And the tax revenues come from two human activities. The first one that generates the most amount of activity in Western civilization is unlawful activity, activity on the part of humans that is contrary to the constitutions of their land. That's the number one tax revenue mechanism. So all licenses of privilege, not licenses of competency, but licenses of privilege, okay, are part of supporting, such as marriage, such as, you know, MD, a builder, all license of privileges support unlawful activity. And so people are taxed on that based on their unlawful activity. Marriage licenses unlawful activity. And it generates over $90 billion a year in revenue, just that one penalty. I think that's primitive. I think humanity has come to a point where we need to grow, we need to move on beyond that kind of concept. And the answer, where we go from there, we have to have tax revenue, but where we get it has to be geared and structured around, I propose, accountability. Accountability to our environment, accountability to what we do to each other and to our planet.
Eli, we only have about 2 minutes left.
Yes, yes.
Is there a first step that people can take, reading your manuscripts, but is there a first step they can take to do something to help the country, to help themselves, and then read your manuscripts and do the rest?
Well, be bold enough to consider the value of reducing their reliance upon benefits and privileges. Reduce their alliance or a reliance on the Social Security number. I was raised by folks that were born in the 1800s, and until the end of the Second World War, there wasn't anything as Social Security or Social Security numbers. There was only work. The word job was not a popular word. It was a slang word. And to begin to understand, people just can't stop using their Social Security numbers because they become codependent upon it. Their homes, their health, their everything is dependent upon their Social Security number. But to consider the value of reducing their reliance on it, and in doing so, they're going to increase their asset base. They're going to get closer to the principles and the ideologies that support true freedom provide a consistency and a good platform to move on into the tomorrow.
Give your website one more time, Eli.
Thetimeisnow.us.
And people can write to you there, too?
Yes, or email. We're happy to respond and answer any questions. We also provide asset protection and estate planning services for those who think they can benefit from learning how to live without or relying less upon a Social Security number. The more one relies upon the SSN, the deeper in the system, the deeper in the mire, deeper in the mud that they are. Less, the more life that they can have without it, the stronger, the better foundation they have, and the better ability they have to weather the storms that are surrounding us.
Thank you, Eli, for being with us. I'm sorry, but we got to go.
Well, it's been my pleasure, and thank you for having me.
We will talk to you later, and thank you for joining us here on BBS Radio.
God bless. Bye-bye now.
Hello?
Took a little trip along with Colonel Jackson down the mighty Mississippi. We took a little bacon and we took a little beans, and we caught the bloody British in a town in New Orleans. We fired our guns and the British kept a coming. There wasn't as many as there was a while ago. We fired once more and they began to run it on down the Mississippi to the Gulf of Mexico.
I thought
we looked down a river and we see the British come, and there must have been 100 of them.